Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. Voting is now over. The polls have closed in Myanmar. Pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi joined millions of her fellow citizens voting in the election that could bring her National League for Democracy party to power. VOA's Steve Herman is at the polling station where Aung San Suu Kyi voted.
The question is not whether the NLD is able to be the largest vote-getter among the 90 or more parties that are contesting in this parliamentary election. The question is whether they can capture two-thirds of the parliamentary seats to overcome this distinct advantage that the military and the government have, because a fifth of these seats are reserved for them. So they need this two-thirds and majority to really get through parliament what they want, and more critically, be able to select who will be the next president of Myanmar.
VOA Steve Herman reporting from Myanmar. In spite of increasing indications that it was a bomb that destroyed a Russian passenger airliner last week high over the Sinai Peninsula, the head of Egypt's investigative team says there have been no definitive conclusions reached. All 224 passengers and crew aboard the jet died. Foreign intelligence reports first raised the theory that a bomb exploded aboard the jet based on overheard chatter by known terrorists shortly after the crash. The Islamic State group claimed responsibility. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights has at least 23 Syrian civilians were killed Saturday in suspected Russian airstrikes on a rebel-held town outside of Damascus. Russia, Syria's government, and a U.S.-led international coalition are all carrying out bombing raids in Syria, sometimes in the same areas. This is VOA News. Taiwan's President Ma Ying-jeou says the increase of security and the significance of security and dignity for the Taiwanese people is a key message he shared with China's President Xi Jinping during their historic talks held this weekend in Singapore. VOA's Bill Ide reports.
Since the People's Republic of China was established in 1949, the leaders of Taiwan and China have never met face-to-face. But on Sunday, the two engaged in what is being called a historic 81-second handshake. The meeting was high on symbolism, but saw no major breakthroughs. China considers democratically ruled Taiwan to be part of its territory and has never renounced the use of force to resolve the dispute. Not everyone welcomed the president's meeting, which was announced on short notice. Protests took place in Taipei, Taiwan's capital, and the timing of the talks between Xi and Ma raised questions. Critics also complained that Ma said little about Taiwan's commitment to democracy as a core value of society, in contrast to the Communist Party's role in China. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
Israeli authorities say a Palestinian rammed his car into a group of Israelis in the West Bank today, injuring at least three before Israeli police opened fire, killing the attacker. Officials say at least two of the Israelis had to be hospitalized. The incident is the latest in a wave of violence caused by the rumor that Israel plans to take over an Israeli holy site, an East Jerusalem holy site, rather, that is revered by the Muslims and the Jews and has been under Muslim control for some time. The uptick in the conflict has killed 11 Israelis and at least 73 Palestinians. Israel has consistently denied the rumors concerning the holy site and accuses Palestinian leaders of inciting young people to violence. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter spoke Saturday about the countries of the Asia-Pacific which are concerned about the risk of conflict between those making territorial claims in the South China Sea.
The United States joins virtually everyone else in the region in being deeply concerned about the pace and scope of land reclamation in the South China Sea. The prospect of further militarization, as well as the potential for these activities to increase the risk of miscalculation or conflict among claimant states.
Carter said the pace and scope of land reclamation by China and others increase the risk of miscalculation and should stop. Pope Francis says the leaking of sensitive Vatican documents is a crime and a deplorable act that will not stop him from moving forward with church reforms. The Holy Father's first comments since two people were arrested for leaking documents last week included that this sad fact will certainly not distract me from the work of reform that is moving ahead. The leader of the world's Roman Catholics made his remarks before tens of thousands of people today in St. Peter's Square. Two new books based on the leaks somehow are coming out recently. I'm Marty Johnson in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Trend in Burundi that indicates that Burundi is heading to a genocide in the scale or in the nature of what happened in Rwanda.
The Burundian foreign minister rejects comparisons of the situation in his country to neighboring Rwanda.
As the campaign began, we already harmonized the campaign program for the 8 candidates in the race. And we signed a memorandum of understanding with all those 8 candidates.
Campaigns for Ugandan presidential election begins on Monday.
From radicalization, who is a radical, who is an extremist, to the term terrorism, which does not have a scientific definition so far.
And experts examine ways of challenging the rising levels of radicalization among the youth in Africa. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Burundian foreign minister says it's erroneous for people to conclude that political and security challenges the Central African country currently faces could lead to genocide similar to what Rwanda experienced in 1994. The international community has expressed concern about the escalating violence in Burundi. The African Union warns that if not peacefully resolved, the continued violence could create instability in the country and affect the region. But Foreign Minister Alain Nyamitwe told me the government in Bujumbura is aware of the concerns expressed by the international community.
We have heard reports of growing concern of some international organizations and some partners vis-a-vis the situation in the country. And also vis-a-vis some rhetoric that they have a tendency to compare with the situation which had prevailed in Rwanda in 1994. We have to be very, very clear. There's no trend in Burundi that indicates that Burundi is heading to a genocide in the scale or in the nature of what happened in Rwanda in 1994. We've had incidents that are regrettable, but we have not had anything like a genocide. And everybody is unanimous to recognize the fact that the conflict, if there is any conflict in the country, it is no ethnic tone.
Pragmatically speaking, what is your government doing now to calm the situation that necessitated the international community to express concern about this and make what you describe as an erroneous comparison of the tragedy that happened in 1994 in neighboring Rwanda?
Number one, there's this inter-Burundian dialogue which is ongoing. But also, as you know, we have accepted that commission will accommodate the Burundians who are outside the country. We also have to make sure that the weapons that are illegally possessed by people should be surrendered. Be it as it may, we continue to believe that the people in Burundi need to live in peace and harmony, Hutus and Tutsis alike, because they belong to the same nation.
Next week, it seems the Security Council or the UN will be discussing the situation in Burundi. Will you be there, and what will be your stance when these issues are raised?
Our stance remains the same. I do not know what is going to be the statement of the Secretary General or the UK, which is presiding over the Council for this month of November, or which will be the statements of all the other countries. But we have already, they have already preempted what they're going to say because we've seen some of their statements. Our reaction remains the same. We believe that the country belongs to all the citizens of Burundi, irrespective of their ethnic background. We believe that there are institutions that are in place in the country which are in charge of solving the problems of the country. And we continue to believe that we always work with our international partners, be they regional or continental or global, so to speak. So we believe that we are on track for better solutions to the situation that prevails in the country. But in any case, we continue to say that our country belongs to the Hutus, to the Tutsis, and to the Tuas, that those three components need to live side by side, as they have done over the last more than 500 or 600 of existence of the Kingdom of Burundi, then later on Republic of Burundi.
Some opposition groups have called for international intervention because they accuse the government of using state institutions to crack down on them and to use state institutions such as the security agencies to, violently crack down on them. What is your reaction to such statement with their call for international intervention about what they describe as the growing insecurity and instability in Burundi?
Look, I don't think that what we're going through in the country warrants what people would call international intervention. But I believe that people might have legitimate concerns over what's going on in the country, and that is up to them to know and to decide when exactly to have those concerns. But some of the facts that have been reported about by the opposition, some opposition circles, have not been established by an independent investigation. And that, one has to be very careful that some opposition groups might advance theories and facts which are completely distorted and need to be established by an independent and credible investigation. The AU has sent human rights monitors and military monitors who are on the ground, and I'm quite sure when I talk to them, they don't seem to tell me that there's anything on the ground that would warrant an international intervention.
Alain Nyamitwe is the Burundian foreign minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Bujumbura. Official campaign for the Ugandan presidential election begins on Monday as candidates including incumbent President Yoweri Museveni, former Prime Minister Patrick Amama Mbabazi, and main opposition leader Dr. Chiza Besigye complete establishing their campaign teams. Jotam Taremwa, spokesman for the Ugandan Electoral Commission, told me that the electoral body signed a memorandum of understanding with the political parties to stick to the stipulations in the agreement.
The campaign for presidential election kick off tomorrow, the 9th of November 2016, and they will be ending on the 16th of February 2016. As the campaigns begin, we already harmonized the campaign program for the 8 candidates in the race, and we signed a memorandum of understanding with all those 8 candidates or their official agents, those who are not able to make it. Now, we expect everybody to keep to the harmonized and approved campaign program by the Electoral Commission. Should there be any change on the part of candidate A in the schedule, that change must be communicated to the Electoral Commission for the candidate himself or herself effective. Secondly, these campaigns will be ending at 6 p.m. Ugandan time every day, including the current president, who is also in the race. So we expect that legal requirement to be observed and complied with. Secondly, I want to request that as the candidates go about their campaign, they conduct peaceful and harmonious campaign. We don't want candidates to divide our people along tribal or religious lines. We want peaceful, harmonious campaign, which will keep our country united. And as a commission, we are prepared to deliver a free and fair election on the 18th of February next year.
you spoke about the issue of these presidential candidates avoiding ethnic sentiment or religious sentiment to undermine the bond that exists between Ugandans. How do you enforce this, and what punishment or consequences are there for any candidate who engages in such act that could create violence and instability?
Well, the enforcement is on the part of the police force. We are working closely with the Uganda Police Force in monitoring the campaign programs of the candidates. And if anybody engages in those, there are sanctions within the law that can be applied. So for now, I can only say that we wish them to stick to the law, and if they violate the law will be pulled out, and those sanctions that we are spelled out.
How long should these parties notify the Electoral Commission if there is a change in their programming, or they want to amend the programs of their campaign in the run-up to the election?
Well, I need to check, but I know they are supposed to inform us a few days ahead of the changes so that we are able to look at their request and have time to decide on their request.
What is the monitoring mechanism to ensure these stipulations that they have agreed to in the Memorandum of Understanding is strictly enforced, particularly when it comes to the period within which they will campaign in a specific day and in a specific area till the 16th of February next year, when official campaign ends?
It is not entirely monitoring. But the Memorandum of Understanding is legal because it is under our electoral laws. So if one violates it, then he is breaking the law. But in terms of monitoring and supervision, we have districts. We have our offices in every district of Uganda. And each of our districts should have that campaign program for all the candidates. The police is on alert. The security agencies are on alert. They are all monitoring. So the monitoring will be there 24 hours to see how one conducts himself or herself during the campaign period.
What do you say to opposition politicians who are expressing concern already that enforcing this electoral law will be biased, since the police always favor the ruling party against the opposition groups? How will this be an equal playing field during this campaign period?
No, that is not correct. It is an allegation. And if anyone has a complaint in respect to that, the commission is always there to address those complaints. But for now, I can say that is not correct. It is a mere allegation.
Jotam Taremwa is the spokesman for the Electoral Commission of Uganda. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Meanwhile, the Ugandan February 2016 election will be held without the electoral reforms that were demanded by the opposition and civil society groups. Charles Mpaji is the communications manager of the Citizen Coalition for Electoral Democracy in Uganda. Reporter Douglas Mpuga reached him in the capital, Kampala, for an update on the organization's demands for electoral reforms.
No substantial reforms were undertaken by the government of Uganda heading into this election. So largely the set of laws that we are going to stand this election under are old electoral laws, because the reform bills were presented in Parliament rather late, and therefore the government itself said the substantial reforms would have to be decided to the next parliament. So we are running largely on the old set of laws.
So in that case, what makes this election different from the previous ones?
And nothing substantial, though a few things have changed. This election, if you look at it outside of the legal regime under which it's going to be held, it is pretending to have much more tighter competition given the candidates that have been nominated. As you might already be aware, 8 candidates have been nominated, but largely a majority of Ugandans are focusing on 3. And these 3 sprung from the same root, essentially. That is the incumbent President Yoweri Museveni, his former Prime Minister and Secretary General of the ruling National Resistance Movement Organization, or party, Amama Mbabazi, who severed relations with the party and the President only last year, And of course, Dr. Kizza Besigye, who's been running for the last 3 years. Now, the big question is, one of the major differences between this election and the last election is that the voters register, which is a critical component of any election, especially in this part of the world, is a register that has been drawn from data collected during the National Security Information System recruitment or the writing of the National Identity Card. Now, the process that created the National Identity Card was a controversial one. The law under which the National ID was generated was passed retrospectively. As the Citizens Coalition for Electoral Democracy in Uganda, we did carry out an observation of the National ID registration, and we released a report expressing some concerns about the numbers and the process, but overall, the enrollment of people was largely successful.
The other candidates, apart from the incumbent, have expressed concerns about the constitution of the Electoral Commission. And if they don't have confidence in it, how do you think it's going to work out?
Yes, one candidate, particularly Dr. Kizza Besigye, this is the fourth time he's running for this job, and he says on all the previous occasions he has won, but he has only been cheated, has said he's going to run a campaign of defiance, not one of compliance. And that is causing a bit of debate. Yes, that was one of the major reforms that CEDU had suggested when it presented the model bill in December 2013, which was to say to give confidence to the electoral process in this country, to give comfort to the people who run the election, that is, members of the Electoral Commission. We needed as a country to change the manner in which commissioners are appointed. We needed also to give them, to guarantee their security of tenure, so that when they are running the affairs of the Electoral Commission, they are confident that they cannot be fired at the whims of an individual appointing authority, who in that case is the president. Now, those concerns were not addressed, and there lingers on a perception that they are largely lenient on the incumbent president, Yoweri Museveni, who is also a candidate in this election. Some of these discomforts were seen in the period leading up to the nomination. The role of the police and the powers between the police and the Electoral Commission, the application of the Public Order Management Act, are some of the issues that are continuing to come up. And if critics here would think, you'd be tempted to think that the failure to reform the Electoral Commission Act is part of the problem.
Charles Impaji is the communications manager of the Citizen Coalition for Electoral Democracy in Uganda. He spoke with reporter Douglas Mpuga from Kampala. Religious excuses for incidents of violence have been on the rise in Africa. At a meeting in Nairobi recently, experts examined ways of challenging the rising levels of radicalization among the youth. For VOA, Ruben Kiyama reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Participants from Nigeria, Cameroon, and Kenya explored the local contexts of religious violence and examined the potential responses of African governments and security agencies. Speakers compared violent groups in northeast Nigeria, north Cameroon, and the coastal and northeast region of Kenya and cited various common factors that explore the problem. Miss Fatma Chari Mohammed, a security expert from Nigeria, was among the key speakers at the forum.
It's about addressing the fundamental issues. The fundamental issues being the socioeconomic issues, the governance issues, corruption, weak states, holding our leadership accountable, the issue of impunity, the lack of understanding of the core issues where ideology is concerned.
Father Wilbert Lago, Assistant Bishop of the Catholic Archdiocese of Mombasa, said religious leaders in collaboration with state organs and local communities were involved in finding solutions to the problem. He said one way was trying to ensure that the voices of the youth were heard. While this is not new for countries like Nigeria, Cameroon, and to some extent Kenya, it is a relatively novel phenomenon in the continent. Ms. Hawa Noor, a researcher at the Nairobi-based Institute of Security Studies, says there is a challenge in finding a clear definition of the words radicalization and terrorism.
from radicalization, who is a radical, who is an extremist, to the term terrorism, which does not have a scientific definition so far. So I think that is where the dilemma starts, and then it boils down to, you know, the whole issue of the perception of within particular societies like Kenya, which has been affected by the problem of violent extremism.
Pundits say that many times exaggerated narratives and perceptions have been employed by national governments to justify punitive measures against entire communities. In Kenya, the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has carried out several assaults across the country in the past few years, including the deadly massacre in 2013 at the Westgate shopping mall in Nairobi that left 67 people dead. In Cameroon, Boko Haram attacks have become the most visible sign of radicalization as the extremist group spreads violence from neighboring Nigeria. Reuben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Turning to Central Africa, like many educated people in Cameroon, Timothy Awanga found that a college degree did not guarantee him a better life. His life changed for the better when he learned to cultivate an abundant natural resource in his home village, bees. He became an entrepreneur selling bees and their byproducts, honey and beeswax. Now he's using bees to transform the lives of many others. He's teaching hundreds of young people to set up little honey enterprises of their own. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
42-year-old Timothy Awanga teaches 15 Cameroonian youths about honeybee colonies near his home in Batom, a village 70 kilometers from Yaoundé. He takes them through his 30 bee hives, each of which holds at least 30,000 bees.
Il faut juste enfermer les abeilles dans leur ruche et ça ne se fait que dans la nuit.
He waits until night time when the hive is full of worker bees returned from collecting nectar. Then he locks the hive and brings it to his trainee bee farmers. After graduating from university 20 years ago, Awanga had no job, so decided to return to his village. There, he began harvesting honey from beehives. Selling bees, honey and bees wax has helped him provide for his wife and four children, and he also has trained several hundred Cameroonians to be bee farmers. Andrew Gisele, one of the youths Awanga has taught, now has his own bee farm in Corbison on the capital's outskirts.
Nous aurons 7 emplois directs. Nous avons appelé ça le système de
stratégie. A strategic honey development program has created 7 jobs in Corbison since it began 5 months ago, he says, and the hope is to expand the village industry to other suitable areas. Cameroon now sees honey as a non-timber forest product that can help reduce poverty, strengthen biodiversity, and conserve natural resources. The government uses Awanga's bee enterprise as a pilot center for future bee farms. The nation's livestock minister, Dr. Tiger, says bee farming is being promoted in all of the country's agricultural training centers, not only to create jobs and generate revenues, but also to conserve environmental resources.
Ce centre forme des jeunes qui sont destinés à pouvoir pratiquer.
The training teaches young people not only how to become professional bee farmers, he says, but also to grow their enterprises, to create more jobs and economically empower other young Cameroonians. The Ministry of Agriculture estimates there are 20,000 farmers in this country who earn about 30% of their annual income from selling honey, bees and related products. The government is unable to say how much honey they produce because it tends to be traded in small quantities in local markets where sales are not recorded. However, those who are trying to transform bees and honey into money and wealth face plenty of difficult problems, from hive construction to a lack of storage and processing equipment to bush fires, pests and a shortage of skilled labor. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, right here in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Nigeria and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, November 8th. The 2015 FIFA Under-17 World Cup in Chile rounds off later today, Sunday, with the final match between the West African nations of Mali and Nigeria. Though the match is slated for Sunday night in the South American country, it will extend to early Monday in Africa, due to time difference. While no one is sure of how the final match will end, one thing is certain, the trophy is staying put in Africa. While Nigeria's Golden Eaglets are the tournament's defending champions, their Malian counterparts are the African champions. Sunday's final will mark the second time in the history of the two-yearly FIFA Under-17 World Cup that two African teams will clash in the final. Turning to athletics, Kenyan runner Eliud Kipchoge and Ethiopia's Mari Dibaba have won the 2015 Marathon Runner of the Year awards in the men's and women's categories, respectively. The two Africans bagged the honors on Friday at the third annual edition of the Best Marathon Runner of the Year awards, organized by the Association of International Marathons and Distance Races, or AIMS, in Athens, Greece. The 31-year-old Kipchoge has had a tremendous year, winning high-quality races in Chicago, London, and Berlin. In every one of those races, he achieved world-class times. Here is Kipchoge after winning the award.
Yes, actually, I want to thank sincerely to all those who have been side by side for me for the last 13 years, especially my coach, management, also the members of the press who have been actually airing my name in a high profile in the whole world, and the organization. Actually, this is a very good and very high trophy for me.
Kipchoge also said his next target is to win a gold medal at next year's Rio Olympics.
I really want to hang that gold medal in my neck. That's the only thing. I have now aims. I have the medals from World Championships, but I don't have a gold from Olympic Games.
That was Kenyan runner Eliud Kipchoge speaking in an interview with Andy Edwards after being named the 2015 Male Marathon Runner of the Year on Friday. For the winner of the female category of the award, 26-year-old Mari Dibaba, she achieved the greatest moment in her career so far when she won the world title in Beijing, China in August. She has also enjoyed an impressive run of success in the marathon since 2014, winning in Chicago and then running the world-class times of 2 hours, 19 minutes, and 52 seconds for victory in China in January, the second fastest women's time this year. Back to football news. Second round action in the African qualifying for the 2018 FIFA World Cup in Russia is set to kick off this week and run through next week. The 40 teams involved in the second stage will play their first and return leg matches from November 12th to 17th, 2015. Group winners will qualify to fly the African flag at the 2018 FIFA World Cup in Russia. Meanwhile, Ghana's national team will kick off preparations on Monday in the capital city of Accra for its upcoming qualifying games against Comoros. Black Stars coach Avram Grant, who returned from a 3-month players monitoring mission in Europe on Friday, has released his list of 23 players for the doubleheader, which includes captain Asamoah Gyan and Andre Ayew, both of whom are returning from injuries. Comoros will host the first leg on November 13th, while the return leg will be played in Kumasi 4 days later. And African Footballer of the Year Yaya Toure has again turned down a call-up from his country and will miss the start of Ivory Coast's World Cup qualifying campaign. The 32-year-old midfielder has not played for his country since it won the African Nations Cup in February. He told the Ivorian Federation he wanted time to reflect on adding to a century of international caps. Ivory Coast plays in Liberia on November 13th and then hosts the fellow West African team 4 days later. Finally, the West African nation of Sierra Leone can now host international matches. This is because the World Health Organization, WHO, on Saturday declared the country free of Ebola. Sierra Leone recorded the highest cases of Ebola disease at over 14,000 cases, followed by Liberia with over 10,000 cases and Guinea with nearly 4,000. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Klote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sport Nightline, Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Your lover, baby, please give me. Oh. I'm going crazy. Oh, let me be your maga. Your maga. I want to be your maga. Your lover.
Tell me what you want.
Oh, oh, oh. Hey. Hey.
I just wanna know your need.
Cause the way you dey touch the body, I like the way you dey do the body. Make me want to dey gummy body, gummy body.
Ha, okay.
Eh? Oh yeah, the popo.
Baby, let me go the popo.
Ah.
Oh yeah, the popo.
Eh?
Baby, let me go the popo. Cause you know the popo, so let me go the popo.
Oh yeah, tonight. Oh tonight.
Baby, please give me.
Maga. I want to be your maga. Your lover.
Tonight.
Baby, please give me. I'm going crazy.
Tonight.
Oh, let me be your maga. Your maga.
Tonight.
I want to be your maga.
I said,
your lover.
Tonight.
There is something about this, your body, where they make me get jolly. When I see you, my baby,
hey.
I just like you happy. Oh, 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 my baby. They sweep me, oh, 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 my baby. Tonight, oh, yeah, limpopo.
Baby, let me go limpopo.
What?
Oh, yeah, limpopo. Baby, let me go limpopo.
Okay.
Cause you go limpopo. So let me go limpopo.
Oh, yeah. Tonight. Oh, tonight.
Oh.
Baby, please give me.
Tonight.
I want to be your maga. Your lover.
Tonight.
Baby, please give me. I'm going crazy.
Hey.
Let me be your maga.
Let me be your maga.
I want to be your maga. Your lover.
Tonight.
I want to
I don't think about you. It make me the wonder because because she loved me so, so tender. Yeah. But now I am darling, cause here is so, so boring. For a very, very long time, I don't get shivo. And it be like Senna fever, I dey catch it cold.
Going out tomorrow.
See, I dey catch it cold. Baby, I dey catch it cold. Oh, you know, no. I said, baby, I dey catch it cold.
Yeah. Oh, you know,
see. I said, baby, I dey catch it cold. No. Baby, run so fast. Come, warugawa. Person go die. Hey, yeah. Person go die, hey, yeah. Ige, where's it going? I wanna touch non-stop, I wanna lean on your shoulder.
It is getting colder.
For a very, very long time, I don't get shivo. And it be like Senna fever, I dey catch it cold.
Going out tomorrow.
See, I dey catch it cold.
Going out tomorrow.
Baby, I dey catch it cold.
Baby,
going out tomorrow. Baby, I dey catch it cold.
Hey, oh, you not see?
I said, baby, I dey catch it cold. No. Baby, run so fast. Come, warugawa. Person go die. Hey, yeah.
Person go die.
Hey, yeah. Ige, where's it going? To Wemu. Omali talk as a man. I wanna touch non-stop. I wanna lean on your shoulder. It is getting colder.
Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Deservedly, the people of Sierra Leone celebrated the announcement by World Health Organization, WHO, that Sierra Leone was free of Ebola transmission. It has been a long and treacherous journey of 18 months. Despite enormous difficulties, disagreements about goals, setbacks, and profound frustrations, President Ernest Bai Koroma, with a steady hand, provided exceptional leadership. He was ably assisted by the National Response Team, which was impressive and effective. The team was able to assist in the mobilization of the people about the do's and don'ts of the Ebola virus and to make clear government's intentions, particularly when movements were restricted and people were confined. The team also was able to let the international community know the progress that were being made. Make no mistake, the Ebola epidemic ravaged the normal life of the people of Sierra Leone. Relationships were upended. Because of restriction of movement, the economy was put in a bad situation, even though before the crisis, it was an ebullient economy with very high growth. The customary relationship between families in the implementation of morals and traditions such as funerals were put on hold, and the contacts between Sierra Leoneans and the compatriots in the diaspora was put in jeopardy. So it is understandable that though with mixed emotions, the people of Sierra Leone should be lustily celebrating this achievement. President Koroma was faced with difficulties in contacts with some of international organizations, and all the more issued the congratulations for standing firm and leading the ship of state to this safe harbor. But we should also take this to be a time of reflection, to find out what lessons have been learned, to reconsider the enormous sacrifices of those in the health sector, losing some of our prominent doctors and nurses, and even those from abroad. We should try very much to see that the government redoubled its efforts in building a robust health sector. Education should be strengthened, public and adult education. Undoubtedly, the high incidence of illiteracy and attachment to customs complicated the work of the government and those fighting the Ebola virus. There also should be a much deal of worrying what would happen next. There should be a decent interval before people abandon the practice which they have followed during this difficult period. Vigilance should be the key word, because we should not forget what happened to Liberia after it was declared Ebola-free and afterwards had to return to the countdown. Sierra Leone has porous borders with Guinea, the country which is still tackling the problem of the Ebola virus. And therefore, government and the people should remain very vigilant. It is a happy occasion that Sierra Leone has now joined Liberia. But both Liberia and Sierra Leone should watch what is going on in Guinea and praying, and if possible, to give all assistance possible so that Guinea too could become Ebola-free. The international community, despite some disagreement with the government, played a crucial role. And this shows the need for continued cooperation so that the West African sub-region will be rid forever of this deadly virus. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Segun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Aiden Utku, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a wise person who knows proverbs reconciles difficulties. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
During his trip to Central Asia, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry traveled to Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan, where he spoke at the opening ceremony of the new campus of the American University of Central Asia. By supporting this institution of higher learning, the U.S. hopes to open educational opportunities to more Central Asian students, giving them a brighter economic future and a greater stake in the Kyrgyz Republic's parliamentary democracy. The U.S. has already provided more than $30 million to the American University of Central Asia, including nearly $6 million in financing through the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. More than 1,000 scholarships have been granted, including to Kyrgyz and Afghan students. Over the past quarter century, more than 25,000 students from the region have visited the United States to study. The goal is to see that number grow to more than 31,000 over the next 5 years. Aside from the economic benefits, a critically important function of education, said Secretary of State Kerry, is that it provides a fundamental foundation for democracy. And democracy, he said, is in turn the foundation of a lasting ability to have prosperity and peace. Democracy does a better job than any other form of government in respecting the rights of individuals and is the best way for citizens to realize their aspirations. Secretary Kerry stressed that democracy can never be taken for granted. It is a pursuit that must be renewed and revitalized by every generation, and it requires every single person to transform his or her sense of right and wrong into action, to nurture a strong civil society that can hold governments accountable, and to stand up for all citizens, including men and women of diverse religious and ethnic backgrounds. It takes work to keep democracy. And the American University of Central Asia has provided thousands of students with a world-class education and the opportunity to go out and do that work. It is up to the students there to make the most of their opportunity. And I can promise you that as you make that effort, said Secretary Kerry, the United States of America will be there as a friend every step of the way.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.